and on my own, I should do it. Take the opportunity. But now, here he is, unexpectedly vulnerable before me, and I don't make a single gesture. Besides, if I try to kill him here, there's zero chance I'll see day again, or survive. Anden sits down beside me, careful to leave some distance between us. Suddenly, I'm embarrassed by my appearance, slouched and weary, with undone hair and nightclothes, seated next to the Republic's handsome prince. But I still straighten and tilt my head up as gracefully as I can. I am June Eparis, I remind myself. I'm not going to let him see the chaos I'm feeling.
I wanted to let you know that you were right, he starts.
There's genuine warmth in his voice.
Two soldiers in my guard went missing this afternoon. Ran away.
The two Patriot decoys have escaped, as planned. I sigh and give him a rehearsed look of relief, just in case Razor is watching. Where are they now?
We're not sure. Scouts are trying to track them.
Anden rubs his gloved hands together for a moment.
Commander DeSoto has instated a new rotation of soldiers that will accompany us.
Razor. He's putting his own soldiers in place, gradually moving in for the kill.
I'd like to thank you for your help, June. Anden goes on. I want to apologize for the lie detector test you had to undergo. I know it must have been unpleasant for you, but it was necessary. At any rate, I'm grateful for your honest answers. You'll stay here with us for a few more days, until we're sure the danger of the Patriots' plans is past. We may still have some questions for you. After that, we will figure out how to integrate you back into the Republic's ranks.
Thank you, I say, even though the words are completely hollow. Anden leans in.
I meant what I said at our dinner, he whispers,
his words rushed and his mouth barely moving. He's nervous. A sudden paranoia seizes me. I tap a finger against my lips and give him a pointed look. His eyes widen, but he doesn't shy away. He gently touches my chin, then pulls me toward him as if he were going to kiss me. He stops his lips right beside my own, letting them rest ever so slightly against the skin of my lower cheek. Tingles run down my spine, and along with them, an undercurrent of guilt.
So the cams don't pick it up,
he whispers. This is a better way to talk in private. If a guard were to poke his head inside the door, it would seem like Anden's stealing a kiss, instead of whispering with me. A safer rumor to spread. And the Patriots would just think I'm going along with their plans. Anden's breath is warm against my skin.
I need your help, he murmurs. If you were pardoned of all crimes against the Republic and set free, would you be able to contact Day? Or is your relationship with him over now that you're not with the Patriots?
I bite my lip. The way Anden says relationship makes it sound like he thinks there was once something between Day and me. Once.
Why do you want me to contact him?
I ask. His words have a quiet, commanding urgency that gives me goosebumps.
You and Day are the most celebrated people in the Republic. If I can form an alliance with you both, I can win the people. Then, instead of quelling rebellions and trying to keep things from falling apart, I can concentrate on implementing the changes this country needs.
I feel lightheaded. This is sudden, startling, and for a moment I can't even think of a good response. Anden is taking a huge risk talking to me like this. I swallow, my cheeks still burning from his proximity. I shift a little so I can see his eyes.
Why should we trust you?
I say, my voice steady.
What makes you think Day wants to help you?
Anden's eyes are clear with purpose.
I'm going to change the Republic, and I'm going to start by releasing Day's brother.
My mouth turns dry. Suddenly I wish we were talking loud enough for Day to hear.
You're going to release Eden?
He should never have been taken in the first place. I'll release him along with any others being used along the warfront.
Where is he?
I whisper.
When are you?
Eden has been traveling along the warfront for the past few weeks. My father had taken him, along with a dozen others, as part of a new war initiative. They're basically being used as living biological weapons.
Andin's face darkens.
I'm going to stop this mad circus. Tomorrow my order will go out. Eden will be taken from the war front and cared for in the capital.
This is new. This changes everything. I have to find a way to tell Day about Eden's release before he and the Patriots kill the one person with the power to free him. What's the best way to communicate with him?
The Patriots must be watching all of my moves from the cams, I think, letting my mind spin. I'll need to signal him.
Day's face appears in my thoughts, and I want to run to him. I want so much to tell him this good news.
Is it good news? My practical side pulls at me, warning me to take this slowly. Andin might be lying, and this could all be a trap. But if it was just another attempt to arrest Day, then why wouldn't he just threaten to kill Eden? That would bring Day out of hiding. Instead, he's letting Eden go.
Andin waits patiently through my silence.
I need Day to trust me,
he murmurs. I put my arms around his neck and move my lips closer to his ear. He smells like sandalwood and clean wool.
I'll need to find a way to contact him and convince him. But if you release his brother, he will trust you.
I whisper back.
I'm going to win your trust too. I want you to have faith in me. I have faith in you. I've had faith in you for a very long time.
He's quiet for a second. His breathing has quickened, and his eyes change abruptly. Gone is that sense of distant authority, and in this moment, he's just a young man, a human being, and the electricity between us is too much. In an instant, he turns his face and his lips meet mine. I close my eyes. It is so light, barely there, yet I can't help but want a little more. With Day, there's a fire and a hunger between us, even anger, some deep desperation and need. With Andin, though, the kiss is all delicacy and refined grace, aristocratic manners, power, and elegance. Pleasure and shame wash through me. Can Day see this through the cams? The thought stabs at me. It lasts for mere seconds, then Andin pulls away. I let out a breath, open my eyes, and let the rest of the room come back into focus. He's spent enough time here. Any longer and the guards outside might start to worry.
I'm sorry to disturb you,
he says, bowing his head slightly before standing up and straightening his coat. He's pulled back into the shelter of formality, but there's a slight awkwardness in his stance, and a faint smile on the edges of his lips.
Get some rest. We'll talk tomorrow.
Once he's gone, and the room has fallen back into a thick silence, I curl up with my knees at my chin. My lips burn from his touch. I let my mind wrap around what Andin just said to me, and my fingers run repeatedly over the paperclip ring on my hand. The Patriots had wanted Day and me to join them in assassinating this young elector. By assassinating him, they claimed, we'd be stoking the fires of a revolution that would free us from the Republic, that we could bring back the glory of the old United States. But what does that mean, really? What will the United States have that Andin can't give the Republic? Freedom? Peace? Prosperity? Will the Republic become a country full of beautifully lit skyscrapers and clean, wealthy sectors? The Patriots had promised Day that they would find his brother and help us escape to the colonies. But if Andin can do all of these things with the right support and the right determination, if we won't need to flee into the colonies, then what is this assassination accomplishing? Andin isn't remotely like his father. In fact, his first official act as the elector is undoing something his father had put in place. He's going to free Eden, maybe even stop the plague experiments. If we keep him in power, would he change the Republic for the better? Wouldn't he be the catalyst that Mateus had wished for in his defiant journal entries? There's a bigger problem I can't wrap my head around. Razor must know, on some level, that Andin isn't a dictator like his father was. After all, Razor's high enough of a rank to hear any rumors of Andin's rebellious nature. He'd told Day and me that Congress disliked Andin, but he never told us why they were clashing. Why would he want to murder a young elector who would help the Patriots establish a new republic? In the midst of my churning thoughts, though, one stays clear. I know for certain where my loyalties lie now. I won't help Razor assassinate the Elector, but I have to warn Day, so he doesn't follow through with the Patriots' plans.
I need a signal. Then I realize that there might be one way to do it, as long as he's watching footage of me along with the rest of the Patriots. He won't know why I'm doing it, but it's better than nothing. I lower my head slightly, then lift my hand with Day's paperclip ring on it, and press two fingers against the side of my brow. Our agreed signal when we first arrived on the streets of Vegas. Stop.
Day. Later that night, I head out to the main conference room and join the others to hear about the next phase of the mission. Razor's back again. Four Patriots continue to work in a smaller cluster at one corner of the room, mostly hackers from what I can tell, analyzing how speakers are mounted on some building or other. I'm starting to recognize a few of them. One of the hackers is bald and built like a tank, if a bit short. Another has a giant nose set between half-moon eyes and a very thin face. A third one is a girl missing an eye. Almost everyone has a scar of some sort. My attention wanders to Razor, who's addressing the crowd at the front of the room, his figure outlined in light with all the world map screens behind him. I crane my neck to see if I can catch Tess milling around with the others, to take her aside and try to apologize. When I finally catch sight of her, though, she's standing with a few other medics in training, holding out some sort of green herb in her palm and patiently explaining how to use it. Or so I think. I decide to save my apology for later. It doesn't seem like she needs me right now. The thought makes me sad and oddly uncomfortable.
Day!
Tess finally notices me. I give her a quick wave in return. She makes her way over to me, then pulls out two pills and a small roll of clean bandages from her pocket. She pushes them into my hands.
Stay safe tonight, okay?
She says breathlessly, fixing me with a firm stare. There's no sign of the earlier tension between us.
I know how you get when your adrenaline's pumping. Don't do anything too crazy.
Tess nods at the blue pills in my hand.
They'll warm you up if it's too cold out there.
Acts old enough to be my caretaker, I swear. Tess's concern leaves a warm feeling in my stomach. Thanks, cousin, I reply, tucking her gifts away in my own pockets.
Hey, I...
She stops my apology with a hand on my arm. Her eyes are as wide as ever. So comforting that I find myself wishing she could come with me.
Whatever. Just promise me you'll be careful.
So quick to forgive in spite of everything. Had she said those things to me earlier in the heat of the moment? Is she still angry? I lean over and give her a brief hug. I promise. And you be safe too. She squeezes my waist in response, then heads off to rejoin the other young medics before I can attempt my apology again. After she's gone, I turn my attention back on Razor. He points to a grainy video that shows some street near the Lamar train tracks Kaede and I had passed earlier. A pair of soldiers hurry across the screen, their collars flipped up against the falling sleet, each of them munching on steaming empanadas. My mouth waters at the sight. The Patriots' canned food is a luxury, but man, what I wouldn't give for a hot meat pastry. First of all, I'd like to reassure everyone that our plans are on the right track, he says. Our agent has successfully met with the Elector and told him about our decoy assassination plan. He circles an area of the screen with his finger. Originally, the Elector had planned to visit San Angelo on his morale-boosting tour, then head here to Lamar. Now word is that he'll be coming to Piera instead. A few of our soldiers will be accompanying the Elector instead of his original troop. Razor's eyes sweep over me, then he gestures to the screen and falls silent. A video replaces the grainy Lamar train track scene. We're seeing footage of a bedroom. The first thing I notice is a slender figure seated on the edge of a bed, her knees tucked up to her chin. June? But the room is a nice one. Certainly doesn't look like a prison cell to me, and the bed looks soft and thickly layered with blankets I would have killed to have back in Lake. someone grabs my arm.
Hey, there you are, Hotshot.
Pascal's standing beside me, that permanently cheery grin plastered all over his face and those pale gray eyes pulsing with excitement. Hey, I reply, giving him a quick nod and greeting before turning my attention back to the screen. Razor has started giving the group a general overview of the next phase of the plans, but Pascal tugs on my sleeve again.
You, me, and a few other runners are heading out in a couple of hours.
His eyes flicker to the video before settling back on me.
Listen up. Razor wanted me to give my crew a more specific rundown than the one he's delivering to the group. I just briefed Baxter and Jordan.
I'm barely paying attention to Pascal anymore because now I can tell that the small figure on the bed is June. It must be her, what with the way she pushes her hair behind her shoulders and analyzes the room with a sweeping gaze. She's dressed in pretty cozy-looking night clothes, but she's shivering as if the room's cold. Is this elegant bedchamber really her prison cell? Tess's words come back to me.
Day, have you forgotten? June killed your mother.
Pascal tugs on my arm again and forces me to face him, then leads me to the back of the group.
Listen up, Day, he whispers again. There's a shipment coming into Lamar tonight by train. It'll have a cartload of guns, gear, food, and whatever else for the warfront soldiers, along with a whole ensemble of lab equipment. We're going to steal some supplies and destroy a rail car's worth of grenades on it. That's our mission tonight.
Now June's talking to the guard standing near the door, but I can barely hear her. Razor's done addressing the room and has fallen deep into conversation with two other patriots, both of them occasionally gesturing up at the screen, then drawing out something on their palms.
What's the point of blowing up a cartload of grenades? I ask. This mission is the decoy assassination. The Elector was originally scheduled to come here to Lamar, at least before June had a talk with him. Our mission tonight should convince the Elector, if he isn't convinced already, that June was telling him the truth. Plus, it'll be a nice chance to steal a few grenades.
Pascal rubs his hands together with almost maniacal glee.
Nitroglycerin.
I raise an eyebrow.
Me and three other runners are going to do the train job, but we'll need a special runner to distract the soldiers and guards.
What do you mean, special?
What I mean, Pascal says pointedly, is that this is why Razor decided to recruit you, Day. This is our first chance to show the Republic that you're alive. It's why Kaede had you strip the dye from your hair. When word gets out that you were seen in Lamar, taking down a Republic train, people are gonna go nuts. The Republic's notorious little criminal, still up and about even after the government's attempt to execute him? If that doesn't stir up people's sense of rebellion, nothing will. That's what we're aiming for. Chaos. By the time we're done, the public will be so pumped about you that they'll be salivating for revolution. It's the perfect atmosphere for the Elector's assassination.
Pascal's excitement makes me smile a little. Messing with the Republic? This is what I was born to do. Give me more details, I say, moving my hand in a come-hither gesture. Pascal checks to make sure Razor's still going through the plans with the others, then winks at me.
Our team is going to unhook the grenade rail car a couple of miles from the station. By the time we get there, I don't want there to be more than a handful of soldiers guarding the train. Be careful now. There usually aren't many troops near those train tracks, but tonight's different. The Republic will be on the hunt for us after hearing June's warning about the decoy assassination. Watch for extra soldiers, buy us the time we need, and make sure they spot you.
Fine, I'll get you your time. I cross my arms and point at him. You just tell me where I need to go. Pascal grins and slaps me hard on the back.
Great. You're the best runner out of us by far. You'll throw those soldiers off without a hitch. Join up with me in 2 hours near the entrance where you came in. We're gonna have a ball.
He snaps his fingers.
Oh, and don't mind Baxter. He's just sore that you get special treatment from both me and Tess.
As soon as he walks away, my eyes go back to the video screen and stay frozen on June's figure. As it continues playing, pieces of Razor's conversation with the other patriots reach me.
Enough to hear what's going on, he's saying. She has him in position.
On the video, June seems to be dozing, with her knees tucked up to her chin.
There's no sound at all this time, but I don't think much of it. Then I see someone step inside her cell, a young man with dark hair and an elegant black cloak. It's the Elector. He bends down and starts talking to her, but I can't make out what he's saying. When he gets close to her, June tenses up. I can feel the blood draining from my face. All the chatter and bustle around me fades into the distance. The Elector puts a hand under June's chin and brings her face toward his own. He's taking something that I thought was just for me, and I feel a sudden, shattering sense of loss. I want to rip my eyes away, but even from the corner of my vision I can still see him kissing her. It seems to last forever. I watch, numbly, as they finally pull away from each other, and the Elector steps out of the room, leaving June alone, curled up on the bed. What's going through her mind right now? I can't watch any longer. I'm about to turn my back, ready to follow Pascal out of the crowd and away from the scene. But then, something catches my eye. I look up at the monitor, and just in time, I see June hold up two fingers to her brow in our signal. It's past midnight when Pascal, me, and three other runners paint wide black stripes across our eyes and suit ourselves up in dark warfront uniforms and military caps. Then we head out of the Patriots' underground hideout for the first time since I arrived. A couple of soldiers wander by now and then, but we see more clusters of troops as we head farther out of our neighborhood and cross the train tracks. The sky is still completely covered with clouds, and under the dim streetlights, I can see thin sheets of sleet falling. The pavement's slick with drizzle and icy slush, and the air smells stale, like a mix of smoke and mold. I pull my stiff collar higher, swallow one of Tess's blue pills, and actually wish I was back with her in Los Angeles's humid slums. I tap the dust bomb hidden inside my jacket, double-checking that it's dry. In the back of my mind, the scene between June and the Elector plays on repeat. June's signal was for me. Which part of the plan does she want me to stop? Does she want me to forfeit the Patriots' mission and escape? If I defect now, what will happen to her? The signal could have meant a million things. It could even mean she's decided to stay with the Republic. I shake the thought furiously from my mind. No, she wouldn't do that. Not even if the Elector himself wanted her? Would that make her stay? I also remember that the video footage of them didn't have sound on it. Every other video we've seen has had crisp sound. Razor even insisted on making sure the volume was turned up. Had the Patriots stripped it from this one? Are they hiding something? Pascal stops us in the shadows of an alley not far from the train station. Train arrives in 15 minutes, he says, his breath rising in clouds. Baxter, Iris, you two come with me. The girl named Iris, long and lean with deep-set eyes that constantly dart around, smiles, but Baxter glowers and tightens his jaw. I ignore him and try not to think about whatever he's trying to put in Tess's mind about me. Pascal points to the third runner, a petite girl with copper-colored braids who keeps sneaking glances at me. Jordan, you're going to pinpoint the right rail car for us. She gives Pascal a thumbs up. Pascal's eyes shift to me. Day, he whispers. You know your drill. I tug the edge of my cap. Got it, cousin. Whatever June means, this is no time for me to leave the Patriots behind. Tess is still back there in the bunker, and I have no idea where Eden is. No way I'm going to put both of them in jeopardy. Keep those soldiers busy, yeah? Make them hate you. That's my specialty. I gesture up at the slanted roofs and crumbling walls towering around us. To a runner, those roofs are like giant slides made smooth by ice. I say a silent thanks to Tess. Already the blue pill is warming me up from the inside out, as soothing as a bowl of hot soup on an icy evening. Pascal gives me a wide grin. Well then, let's show them a good time. I watch the others hurry away along the railroad tracks through the veil of sleet. Then I step farther into the shadows and study the buildings. Each one is old and pockmarked with footholds. And to make things even more fun,
They all have rusted metal beams crisscrossing their walls. Some have top floors that are completely blown off and open to the night sky. Others have slanted tiled roofs. In spite of everything, I can't help feeling a twinge of anticipation. These buildings are a runner's paradise. I turn back down the street toward the train station. There are at least two clusters of soldiers, maybe more, that I can't see on the other side. Some are lined up along the tracks in expectation, their rifles hoisted, the black stripes across their eyes gleaming wetly in the rain. I reach up to my face and check my own stripe. Then I pull my military cap down tighter on my head. Showtime. I get a good foothold on one wall and shimmy my way up toward the roof. Every time I tuck my leg in, my calf brushes against my artificial leg implant. The metal is freezing cold, even through fabric. Several seconds later, I'm perched behind a crumbling chimney 3 stories up. From here, I can see that, just as I expected, there's a third group of soldiers on the other side of the train station. I make my way to the other end of the building and then leap silently from building to building until I'm on top of the slanted roof. Now I'm close enough to see expressions on soldiers' faces. I reach into my jacket, make sure my dust bomb is still mostly dry, and then crouch there on the roof to wait. A few minutes pass. Then I stand up, pull out the dust bomb, and fling it as far from the train station as I can. Boom! It explodes in a giant cloud the moment it hits the ground. Instantly, the dust swallows up that entire block and races down the streets in rolling waves. I hear shouts from the soldiers near the train station. One of them yells out, "There! 3 blocks down!" Way to state the obvious, soldier. A group of them breaks away from the station and starts hurrying toward where the dust cloud had blanketed the streets. I slide down the slanted roof. Shingles break off here and there, sending showers of ice mist into the air. But through all the shouting and running below me, I can't even hear myself. The roof itself is slippery as wet glass. I pick up speed. The sleet whips harder against my cheeks. I brace myself as I reach the bottom of the roof and then launch into the air. From the ground, I probably look like some sort of phantom. My boots hit the slanted roof of the next building, this one right next to the train station. The soldiers still there are distracted, staring down the street toward the dust. I do a little hop at the bottom of this second roof, then grab onto the side of a streetlight and slide all the way down the pole to the ground. I land with a quick, muffled crunch on the pavement's streaks of ice. "Follow me!" I shout at the soldiers. They see me for the first time, just another nondescript soldier with a dark uniform and black stripe across the eyes. "There's an attack on one of our warehouses! Could be the Patriots finally showing their faces!" I gesture to both of the groups left. "Everyone! Commander's orders! Hurry!" Then I turn on my heels and start running away from them. Sure enough, the sound of their pounding boots soon follows. No way would these soldiers dare risk disobeying their commander, even if it means leaving the station momentarily unguarded. Sometimes you gotta love the Republic's iron discipline. I keep running. When I've led the soldiers 4 or 5 blocks down, past the dust cloud and several warehouses, I suddenly veer off down a narrow corridor. Before they can turn the corner, I run straight at one of the alley's walls, and when I'm several feet away, I jump up and kick off against the brick. My hands shoot out. I grab onto the second floor's ledge, and it's only the work of the moment to spring up to it. My feet land solidly on the ledge. By the time the soldiers have rushed into the same alley, I've melted into the shadowed crevice of a second floor window. I hear the first ones pause, then their bewildered exclamations. "Now's as good a time as any," I think. I reach up and pull my cap off, letting my white blonde hair tumble loose. One of the soldiers turns his head up fast enough to see me dart out of the window crevice and turn the corner from the second floor ledge. "Did you see that?" someone shouts incredulously. "Was that Day?" As I jam my feet into the spaces of old bricks and pull myself up to the third floor, the soldiers' tones go from confused to angry. Someone shouts at the others to shoot me down. I just grit my teeth and leap up to the third floor. The first bullets ricochet off the wall. One hits inches away from my hand. I don't stop. Instead, I lunge up toward the top floor and swing up onto the slanted rooftop in one move. More sparks light up the bricks below me. Off in the distance, I see the station. The train's arrived, half hidden behind steam and parked unattended except for several soldiers who have stepped off the train itself. I scamper up the roof and slide down its other half, then take another flying leap to the next roof. Down below, some of the soldiers have started rushing back toward the train. Maybe they finally realize that this is all a diversion. My eyes leave the station only when I go flying onto another rooftop. 2 blocks away. Then, an explosion! A bright, furious cloud rolls up from farther down the railroad tracks, and even my rooftop vantage point shudders. The impact makes me lose my balance and fall to my knees. There's the blast Pascal had mentioned. I take in the inferno for a moment, pondering. A lot of soldiers are going to be heading over there. It's dangerous. But if my job is to let the Republic know I'm alive, I better make sure I'm seen by as many people as possible. I push myself back onto my feet and run faster, stuffing my hair back up into my cap as I go. The soldiers below have split into 2 groups, one dashing toward the explosion, the other continuing to trail me. Suddenly, I skid to a stop. The soldiers rush right past the building I'm on. Without wasting another second, I slide down the roof and swing down from the edge of the gutter. Boot into foothold, one after another, I jump down to the pavement. The soldiers probably just realized they'd lost me, but I'm already blending into the shadows on the ground. Now I'm running steadily along the street as if I'm just another soldier. I head for the train. The sleet's coming down harder. The blaze left over from the explosion lights up the night sky, and I'm close enough to the train to hear shouts and pounding feet. Did Pascal and the others get out safely? I quicken my steps. Other soldiers materialize through the sleet, and I fall smoothly into line with them as we jog alongside the train. They're rushing toward the fire.
What happened?
One of them shouts at another.
Don't know. I heard some spark set off the cargo. That's impossible. The rail cars are all covered.
Somebody got a hold of Commander DeSoto. The Patriots made their move. Send word to the Elector. They're...
They continue on. I miss the last half of the sentence. I gradually slow until I'm at the back of the line, then I dart away into the tiny slit between 2 rail cars. All the soldiers I can see are still headed for the blaze. Others are in the area where I'd set off the dust bomb, and the ones who'd been chasing me are probably still bewildered combing the streets I was running. I wait until I'm certain there's no one else near me. Then I slide out from between the rail cars and run along the opposite side of the tracks that the other soldiers were on. I let my hair loose again. Now I just need to choose the right moment to make my grand appearance. There are small markings on each rail car that I pass. Coal, tracked guns, ammunition, food. I'm tempted to stop at the last one, but that's just the lake part of me talking. I remind myself that I'm not scavenging on the streets anymore and that the Patriots have a full pantry in their headquarters. I force myself to keep going. More markings. More warfront supplies. Then I pass a marking that forces me to stop. A shiver runs down my arms and legs. I quickly jog back to see the marked rail car again, just in case I'd imagined it. Nope. There it is, embossed into the metal, the one I'd recognize anywhere. The 3-lined X. My mind whirls. I see the red spray-painted symbol scarring my mother's door, the plague patrols making their way from house to house in Lake. Eden being taken away. There's no way this symbol could mean anything other than the fact that my brother, or something related to him, is on this train. All my interest in the Patriots' plan goes right out of my head. Eden might be in here. I can tell the 2 sliding car doors are locked, so I take a few steps back, then run at it. When I'm close enough, I jump, take 3 fast steps against the car's side, grab the top edge of the car and pull myself up. There's a circular metal seal in the middle of this railcar's roof that they're probably using to access the interior. I crawl over to it, run my fingers along the edges, and find 4 latches holding the seal down. Feverishly, I pry them loose. The soldier should be coming back any second now. I push against the seal with all the strength I've got. It slides open a crack, just enough for me to jump in. I land with a soft thud. It's dark enough so I can't see anything at first. I reach out my hands and touch what feels like a round glass surface. Slowly I begin to make out my surroundings. I'm standing in front of a glass cylinder almost as tall and wide as the rail car, with smooth metal casing on top and bottom. It emits a very faint blue glow. A small figure is lying on the floor inside, with tubes poking out of one of his arms. I know right away that it's a boy. His hair is short and clean, and a mess of soft waves, and he's dressed in a white jumpsuit that makes him stand out against the darkness. A loud buzzing in my ears blocks out anything and everything. It's Eden. It's Eden. It must be him. I've hit the jackpot. I can't believe my luck. He's right here. I found him in the middle of nowhere in all the vastness of the Republic. In a stroke of insane coincidence. I can get him out. We can escape into the colony sooner than I ever thought possible. We can escape tonight. I rush over to the cylinder and pound my fist on the glass, half hoping it shatters, even though I can tell that it's at least a foot thick and almost certainly bulletproof. For an instant, I don't know if he can hear it. But then his eyes open. They dart around in a weird, unfocused way before attempting to settle on me. It takes me a long moment to process the fact that this boy is not Eden. The bitter taste of disappointment stings my tongue. He's so small, so close in age to my brother, that I can't stop the image of Eden's face from overwhelming me. Others exist who are also marked with unusual strains of plague? Well, of course there would be. Why would Eden be the only one in the entire country? The boy and I just face each other for a while. I think he can see me, but he can't seem to fix his gaze. He keeps squinting in a way that reminds me of Tess's nearsightedness. Eden. I think back to the way his irises had bled from the plague. From the way this boy's trying to gauge me, I can tell that he's almost entirely blind. A symptom my brother probably has too. He suddenly snaps out of his trance and crawls over to me as fast as he can. He presses both his hands against the glass. His eyes are a pale, opaque brown, not the creepy black that Eden's had been when I last saw him. But the bottom halves of both irises are dark purple with blood. Does that mean this boy, that Eden, is getting better? Because the blood is draining away? Or worse, because the blood is draining in? Eden's irises had been completely filled with blood the last time I saw him.
"Who's there?"
he says. The glass muffles his voice. He still can't focus on me even at this close range. I snap out of my trance, too.
"A friend,"
I reply hoarsely. "I'm going to get you out." At that, his eyes pop open. Hope instantly blossoms on his small face. My hands run along the glass and search for something, anything that can open this gaudy cylinder.
"How do you operate this thing? Is it safe?"
The boy pounds frantically against the glass. He's terrified.
"Help me, please,"
he exclaims, his voice trembling.
"Get me out! Please get me out of here!"
His words break my heart. Is this what Eden's doing? Terrified and blind, waiting in some dark rail car for me to save him? I have to get this boy out. I steady myself against the cylinder.
"You have to stay calm, kid, all right? Don't panic. What's your name? What city is your family from?"
Tears have started to run down the boy's face.
"My name's Sam Vitanchi. My family's in Helena, Montana."
He shakes his head vigorously.
"They don't know where I went. Can you tell them I want to come home? Can you?"
"No, I can't. I'm so gaudy helpless. I want to punch straight through the rail car's metal sides."
"I'll do what I can. How do you open the cylinder?"
I ask again.
"Is it safe to open?"
The boy points frantically to the cylinder's other side. I can tell he's trying hard to contain his fright.
"Okay, okay."
He pauses in an attempt to think.
"It's safe, I think. There's something over there that they type into,"
he replies.
"I can hear the beeps, and then it makes the tube open."
I rush to where he's pointing. Is it my imagination, or do I hear the faint sounds of boots pounding against pavement?
"It's some sort of glass screen," I say.
The word "locked" stretches across it in red type. I turn back to the boy and knock on the glass. His eyes swivel toward the sound.
"Is there a password? How do they type it in?" "I don't know."
The boy throws his hands up, his words contort with a sob.
"Please, just..."
Damn it. He reminds me so much of Eden. His tears are making my own eyes water.
Come on, I coax, fighting to keep my words strong. Gotta stay in control. Think. Any other way this thing opens aside from the keypad? He shakes his head.
I don't know. I don't know.
I can already imagine what Eden would say if he was this boy. He'd say something technical, thinking like the little engineer that he is. Something like, do you have a sharp edge? Try finding a manual trigger.
Steel yourself.
I pull out the knife that's always at my belt. I'd seen Eden take gadgets apart before and reconfigure all the inner wires and circuit boards. Maybe I should try the same thing. I place the blade against the tiny slit running along the keypad's edge and carefully apply some pressure. When nothing happens, I push harder until the blade bends. Doesn't help at all.
It's too tight, I mutter.
If only June were here. She'd probably figure out how this thing works in half a second. The boy and I share a brief moment of silence. His chin drops to his chest, and his eyes close. He knows there's no way to open it.
I need to rescue him. I need to save Eden. It makes me want to scream.
It's not my imagination. I do hear the soldiers getting closer. They must be checking the compartments.
Talk to me, Sam, I say. Are you still sick? What are they doing to you?
The boy wipes his nose. The light of hope has already faded from his face.
Who are you?
Someone who wants to help, I whisper. The more you tell me, the easier it will be for me to fix this.
I'm not sick anymore,
Sam replies in a rush, like he knows we're running out of time.
But they say I've got something in my blood. They call it a dormant virus.
He stops to think.
They give me medicine to keep me from getting sick again.
He rubs at his blind eyes, wordlessly begging me to save him.
Every time the train stops, they take a blood sample from me.
Any idea what cities you've already been to?
Don't know. I heard the name Bismarck once.
The boy trails off as he thinks.
And Yankton?
Both are warfront cities up in Dakota. I think about the transport they're using for him. It probably maintains a sterile environment, so people can go in and take a blood sample, then mix them with whatever activates the dormant virus. The tubes in his arms might just be for feeding. My best guess is that they're using him as a bioweapon against the colonies. He's been turned into a lab rat, just like Eden. The thought of my brother being shipped around like this threatens to drown me.
Where are they taking you next?
I demand.
I don't know. I want to go home.
Somewhere along the warfront. I can only imagine how many others are being paraded up and down the warfront line. I picture Eden huddled in one of these trains. The boy has started to wail again, but I force myself to cut him off.
Listen to me. Do you know of a boy named Eden? Have you heard that name mentioned anywhere?
His cries grow louder.
No, I don't know who.
I can't linger anymore. Somehow I manage to tear my eyes away from the boys and run to the railcar sliding doors. The soldiers' footsteps are louder now. They can't be more than 5 or 6 cars away. I take one last glance back at the boy. I'm sorry. I have to go. It kills me to say these words. The boy starts to cry again. His hands pound against the cylinder's thick glass.
No!
His voice breaks.
I told you everything I know. Please don't leave me here.
I can't bear to listen anymore. I force myself to step up the side latches of one sliding door and get close enough to the railcar ceiling to grab the edge of the top circular seal. I pull myself out into the night air again, back into the sleet that stings my eyes and whips ice against my face, and struggle to regain my composure. I'm so ashamed of myself. This boy had given me whatever help he could, and this is how I repay him? By running for my life? Soldiers are inspecting the cars some 50 feet away. I slide the seal back into place and shimmy flat against the roof until I've reached the edge. I swing down and land on the ground. Pascal materializes out of the shadows, his pale gray eyes flashing in the dark. He must have been looking for me.
Why the hell are you here?
He whispers.
You were supposed to make a scene near the explosion, yeah? Where were you?
I'm in no mood to play nice.
Not now,
I snap as I start running alongside Pascal. Time to head back to our underground tunnel. Everything whizzes past us in a surreal fog. Pascal opens his mouth to say something else, hesitates when he sees my face, and decides to drop it. He starts again, this time more quietly.
Well, you did good enough. Probably got the word out that you're alive, even without all the extra fireworks. Your run up there on the roofs was pretty amazing. We'll see tomorrow morning how the public reacts to your appearance here.
When I don't reply, he bites his lip and leaves it at that. I have no choice but to wait until Razor's finished with the assassination before they help me rescue Eden. A tide of rage against the young Elector swells up in me.
I hate you! I hate you with everything I've got, and I swear I'm gonna put a bullet in you the first chance I get.
For the first time since I joined the Patriots, I actually find myself excited for the assassination. I'm going to do everything to make sure the Republic can never touch my brother again. In the chaos of the burning fire and shouting of troops, we slip away down the other side of the town and back into the night.
June. Less than 2 days before the Elector's actual assassination. 30 hours for me to stop it. The sun has just set when the Elector, along with 6 senators and at least 4 guard patrols, 48 soldiers, boards a train headed for the warfront city of Piera. I'm riding with them too. This is the first time I'm traveling as a passenger instead of a prisoner, so tonight I'm dressed in warm winter tights and soft leather boots. No heels or steel toes, so I can't use them as weapons. And a hooded duffel cape that's deep scarlet with silver trim. No more shackles. And didn't even make sure I have gloves, soft leather, black and red. And for the first time since arriving in Denver, my fingers don't feel cold. My hair is the way it's always been, clean and dry, pulled back into a high ponytail. In spite of all this, my head feels warm and my muscles ache. All the lamps along the station platform are off, and no one besides the Elector's ensemble is in sight. We board the train in complete silence. And in sudden detour from Lamar to Piera is probably something most of the senators don't even know about. My guards lead me into my own private rail car, a car so luxurious that I know I'm in here only because Andin insisted on it. It's twice as long as the standard rail cars, a good 900 square feet, with 6 velvet curtains and Andin's ever-present portrait hanging against the right wall. The guards lead me to the center table of the car, then pull out a seat for me. I feel a strange detachment from it all, like none of it is quite real. It's as if I were exactly where I used to be, a wealthy girl taking her rightful place amongst the Republic's elite.
"If you need anything, let us know," one of them says.
He sounds polite, but the tightness of his jaw gives away how nervous he is around me. There are no sounds now except for the subtle rattle of the train on the tracks. I try not to focus directly on the soldiers, but from the corner of my eye, I watch them closely. Are there any Patriots disguised as soldiers on this train? If so, do they suspect my shifting loyalties? We wait together in a thick silence. The snow has started up again, piling against my window's outside corners. Curls of white frost decorate the glass. It reminds me of Matthias's funeral, of my white dress and Thomas's polished white suit, the white lilacs and white carpets. The train picks up speed. I lean toward the window until my cheek almost touches the cold glass, watching silently as we approach the looming armor wall that surrounds Denver. Even in the darkness, I can see the train tunnels carved into the armor. Some of them are completely sealed with solid metal gates, while others remain open for night freight to pass through. Our train hurtles into one of the tunnels. I guess trains leaving the capital don't need to stop for inspection, especially if the Elector has approved them. As we leave the enormous wall behind, I see an inbound train slowing for inspection at a checkpoint. We continue on, melting away into the night. The rain-worn skyscrapers of slum sectors stream past the windows, the now familiar view of how people live on the outskirts of a city. I'm too tired to pay much attention to the details. My mind goes over what Andin said to me last night, which leads me back to the endless problem of how to warn Andin and keep Day safe at the same time. The Patriots will know I've betrayed them if I reveal the assassination plot to Andin too early. I need to time my steps, so any planned deviations happen right before the assassination, when I can reach Day easily. I wish I could tell Andin now. Tell him everything. Get it over with. In a world without Day, that's what I would do. In a world without Day, many things would be different. I think about the nightmares I've been having, the haunting thought of Razor putting a bullet in Day's chest. The paperclip ring sits heavy on my finger. Again, I lift two fingers to my brow. If Day didn't catch my first signal, I hope he sees this one. The guards don't seem to think I'm doing anything unusual. It looks like I'm just resting my head. The rail car sways to one side, and a wave of dizziness washes over me. Maybe this cold I have coming on, if it really is a cold, that is, and not something more serious, is starting to affect my logic. Still, I don't raise a request for doctors or medicine. Medicine inhibits the real immune system, so I've always preferred fighting illnesses on my own, much to Mateus's exasperation. Why do so many of my thoughts lead back to Mateus? An aggravated man's voice distracts me from my wandering thoughts. I turn from the window and back to the inside of my rail car. It sounds like an older man. I sit straighter in my chair and can see two figures walking toward me through the tiny window on my rail car door. One is the man I'd just heard, short and pear-shaped, with a scruffy gray beard and a small bulbous nose. The other is Andin. I strain to hear what they're saying. At first, all I can make out are broken hints of their conversation, but their words sharpen as they draw closer to my rail car.
Elector, please. I'm telling you this for your own good. Acts of rebellion need to be met with severe punishment. If you don't react appropriately, it'll only be a matter of time before everything is thrown into upheaval.
Andin listens patiently with his hands behind his back and his head tilted down toward the man.
Thank you for your concern, Senator Camion, but my mind is made up. Now is hardly the time to meet the unrest in Los Angeles with military force.
My ears perk up at this. The older man spreads his arms wide in a gesture of irritation.
Push the people back in line. You need that right now, Elector. Demonstrate your will.
Andin shakes his head.
It'll push people over the edge, Senator. Using fatal force before I have the chance to publicize all the changes I have in mind? No, I won't issue such a command. That's my will.
The senator scratches at his beard in irritation and puts a hand on Andin's elbow.
The public is already up in arms against you, and your leniency will look like weakness, not just externally, but internally too. The LA trial admins are complaining about our lack of response. The protests have forced them to cancel several days' worth of examinations.
Andin's mouth tightens into a stern line.
I think you know how I feel about the trials, Senator. I do, the senator replies sullenly. That's a discussion for another time. But if you don't issue orders that allow us to stop the rioting, I can guarantee that you'll be getting an earful from the Senate and the Los Angeles patrols.
Andin pauses to raise an eyebrow at him.
Is that so? I'm sorry. I was under the impression that our Senate and our military understand exactly how much weight my words carry.
The senator wipes sweat from his brow.
Well, that is, of course, the Senate will bow to your wishes, sir. But I just meant, well...
Help me convince the other senators that this is the wrong time for us to come down on the public. Andin pauses to face the man and claps him on the shoulder.
I don't want to make enemies in Congress, Senator. I want your fellow delegates and the National Court to respect my decisions as they did with my father's. Using fatal force to put down rioters will only incite more anger toward the state. But, sir...
Andin stops outside my rail car.
We'll finish this discussion later, he says. I'm tired.
Even though his reply is muffled by the doors between us, I can hear the steel in his words. The senator mumbles something and bows his head. When Andin nods, the man turns around and hurries away. Andin watches him go, then opens the door to my rail car. The guards salute him. We nod at each other. I've come to deliver your release terms, June. Andin speaks to me with a distant formality, perhaps due to the chilly conversation he just had with the senator. The kiss he'd given me last night feels like a hallucination. Even so, seeing him gives me a peculiar sense of comfort, and I catch myself relaxing against my chair as if I were in the company of an old friend. Last night we received word that there was an attack in Lamar. A train was destroyed in an explosion, the train I was supposed to be on. I don't know the final word on who's responsible, and we failed to catch any of the attackers, but we assume that they were the Patriots. We have teams hunting for them there now. Glad to be of service, Elector, I say. My hands grip each other tightly in my lap, reminding me of the luxurious softness of my gloves. Should I feel so safe and secure in this elite railcar, while Day is probably on the run with the Patriots? If you can think of any other details, Miss Paris, please feel free to share them. You're back in the Republic now. You're one of us. And I give you my word that you have nothing to fear. Once we arrive in Piera, your record will be scrubbed clean. I'll personally see to it that you're reinstated to your former rank, although you'll be placed in a different city patrol. Andin puts his hand to his mouth and clears his throat. I've recommended you for a Denver team. Thank you, I reply softly. Andin is falling right into the Patriots' trap. Some senators feel that we've been too generous with you, but everyone agrees that you are our best hope of tracking down the Patriots' leaders. Andin walks closer and takes a seat before me. I'm sure they'll try to strike again, and I want you to lead my men in intercepting future attempts. You are too kind, Elector. I'm honored, I reply, lowering my head in a half bow. And if you don't mind my asking, will my dog be pardoned as well? Andin chuckles a little. Your dog is being cared for in the capital. He'll be waiting for you when you arrive. I meet Andin's eyes and hold them for a moment. His pupils dilate and his cheeks flush slightly. I can see why the Senate would be unhappy with your leniency, I finally say. But it's true that no one can keep you safer than I can. I need a minute alone with him. But there must be another reason you're being so kind to me, isn't there? Andin swallows and looks up at his own portrait. My eyes dart to the guards, standing at the railcar's doors. As if he knows what I'm thinking, Andin waves a hand at the soldiers, then motions up at the cams in the railcar. The soldiers leave, and a moment later the cam's red blinking lights flick off. For the first time, no one is watching us. We are truly alone. The truth is, Andin continues, you've become very popular with the public. If word gets out that the country's most gifted prodigy is being convicted of treason, or even demoted for disloyalty, well, you can see how poorly that would reflect on the Republic, and on me. Even Congress knows this. My hands curl back and retreat into my lap. Your father's Senate and you have somewhat different moral codes, I say, mulling over the conversation I'd overheard between Andin and Senator Camion moments ago. Or so I gather. He shakes his head and smiles bitterly, to put it lightly. I didn't know you disliked the trials so much. Andin nods. He doesn't seem surprised that I overheard his conversation. The trials are an outdated way of choosing our country's best and brightest. It's odd to hear this coming from the Elector's own mouth. Why is the Senate so intent on keeping them? What's their investment in the trials? Andin shrugs. It's a long story. Back when the Republic first implemented them, they were somewhat different. I lean forward. I've never heard any stories about the Republic that weren't filtered through the country's school or public messaging systems, and now the Elector himself is going to tell me one. How were they different? I ask. My father was very charismatic. Andin actually sounds a bit defensive. Weird reply. I'm sure he must have had his ways, I say, careful to keep neutral. Andin crosses his legs and leans back. I don't like what the Republic has become, he says, forming each word slowly and thoughtfully,
but I cannot say that I don't understand why things are like this. My father had his reasons for doing what he did.
I frown at him.